Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with co-author Wayne Enstis of the 2021 memoir, The Lady Swings, about the life of drummer Dottie Dodgen. Dottie was a force and lived an entire lifetime before she was 17. Undeterred by hardships, she defied the odds and earned a seat as a woman in the exclusive men's club of jazz. Her dues-paying path as a musician took her from early work with Charles Mingus to being hired by Benny Goodman at Basin Street East on her first day in New York. From there, she broke new ground as a woman who played a man's instrument in first-string all-male New York City jazz bands. Wayne recounts the process from start to finish and many spots scattered throughout. Enjoy.
Wayne, thank you for taking a minute, and I'm really looking forward to talking about this book. It's a wonderful read, and before I get into kind of the guts of the actual book, how did all of this come about? How did you get involved? How did this kind of whole process of making this book start?
Well, the book, you might say, started without me. And to be succinct, and you can certainly ask questions if you have them about this progression, I did a book with Paul Rubin called Jazz Spoken Here, and as things turned out, demographics, scheduling, all of the musicians that came through the state in Arizona, came through Arizona when Paul and I were doing an NPR affiliate jazz show and interviewing musicians for that show, all of them were men. But we had good material, and the book was published. Several years later, I developed a conscience about that. I felt that you know, although it was not anything planned, it was just simply logistical. Regardless, there needed to be some attention given, you know, equal attention given to women in women players in jazz, and so I located a co-author, Janice Stockhouse, and we embarked on jazz women. Now, one of the women, and probably the most obscure figure among many who didn't have a strong voice within the culture, you know, because of being women players, but probably the most obscure was Dottie Dodgen. Knew little about her. I did have a recording of her with Ruby Braff, and I knew who she was, but not much depth at all. So it was an adventure to go meet her. Did that. Had a good interview. Published her interview. Came out in 2004. And then the next thing I knew, and I thought I was finished, you know, I mean, Dottie and I had a good working relationship for that period of time. Brief and to the point. About 6 years later, I got a phone call from Dottie, and it turned out that there was a woman named Casey Sovey on the West Coast who's an editor. I believe she writes plays. She's a writer, and she had read Dottie's chapter in Jazz Women and took pains to meet Dottie and proposed that they work together to create a fictional play, a one-woman play, that would be based loosely on Dottie's stories, not Dottie's life, but a fictional play based on her stories. And so they sat down for several years and did tape recordings. Dottie would, you know, simply go over her history and funny things that happened and difficult things, etc., just letting a lot of things out on the tape. And it got to a point where Dottie started to think, because she didn't do this at first. She was doing this with Casey to work with her on this idea of this play. You know, if they got a play together, Casey was talking about, as I understood it, perhaps shopping it around to HBO or to the movies. There was some movement, not much, I don't think, but some interest. Or let's say that they were interested in certain Hollywood figures to maybe get this produced. Well, those things fell through, and Dottie, as she went along, began to realize that, hey, you know, maybe I need to get my story out there. She called me. So out of the blue, I get a call and says, Wayne, I like what you did on, you know, with Jazz Women. Would you be willing to help me with my memoirs? And I had no idea if I wanted to do that, because Jazz Women was a sketch of each of these figures. It wasn't an in-depth profile on any of them. It was introductory, and that was the purpose of the book. It was 6 years since I had spoken with Dottie, and I had not looked into her history any further. So I was a bit flat-footed when it came to answering the question. Luckily, Casey sent me 24 tapes, all these recordings that she and Dottie had made over 3 years. And so my research materials just increased dramatically overnight, receiving all those. Now, there were informal conversations. They were thematically based. They would go from one topic to another, and on a given tape, and then maybe two tapes later, one of the topics would be picked up again. So, you know, I had to listen to the tapes vertically and horizontally to find out, what kind of material there was on it. But it gave me a good sampling, and I decided I would go back out to California, and I spent a week there. Intensely, day after day, Dottie and I sat down for hours, and I went over questions I had based on the Casey tapes, based on the chapter in Jazz Women, and got even more intricate material, research, primary research, talking with her. Came back and launched another aspect of primary research, interviewing musicians who worked with her. Fortunately, numbers of them were still alive. Many of them, sadly, have passed since that time. But I was able to speak with so many, very venerable figures in the jazz world about Dottie's work. So once I was able to organize the material I had, plug it into what Casey sent me, take a look at what the musicians were saying, discussing it with Dottie in more depth, it appeared at that point, like maybe 2 years down the line, that probably we had a book, because we just weren't sure until that time. So the book took off, or the idea for the germ for the book took off back quite a ways, back in 94 with the first book, and the germination continued through Jazz Women, and then thanks to Casey Sylvie and her work with Dottie, and then finally Dottie and I getting together and collaborating for about 10 years.
I guess my question, I know that she passed in September of 2021, September 17th. How did that coincide with the book being released? Did she see it? Was it a big thing for her to see this release?
I think shrouded in mystery, I can tell you what appeared to be... Now, okay, so first of all, we finished up the book a few days before she had the stroke. I mean, the book went into production, and not long after that, she had a massive stroke. Now, previous to that time, we had read Galleys over and over again. That's what we had a very close working relationship, so that we would spend hours going over Galleys, making corrections, then going over them again. The cover, the photographs, the music, all the components were in front of Dottie and were open for, very detailed discussion on the part of the two of us. So she had a very good feel for what this book was going to be like. But she had the stroke, and of course the pandemic was operative at that time. So her daughter couldn't even go to see her for several months. And I certainly was not able to speak with her. Dottie was not able to speak, and regained only, as I understand it. See, I did not see Dottie again. I did not talk with her again. Her daughter would give me reports that she would be able to say that she loved her. You know, Dottie would say that to Deborah, her daughter. Deborah, after she got the okay to visit, took a copy of the book, more than once, I believe. But certainly one time she told me that Dottie took the book in her hand and her face brightened, and she seemed to recognize what it was and to be excited about it. But because she could not speak, because of the effects of the stroke, it's hard to tell if that was really something that she processed fully. So and that's a very sad, you know, sort of you know, conclusion to the book. I mean, you should be talking with Dottie now. Obviously, I'm a stand-in. I'm the scribe. You know, Dottie is the feature here. Well, one of the things that I found very poignant is, and this is again Deborah telling me, she went in not long before Dottie died, maybe a few days is my impression anyway, and Dottie told her that I guess during the night, that Miles Davis was sitting on her bed, and I'm paraphrasing here, but Miles, she told Deborah that Miles said to her, "Your book's going to be a big hit." She had enough a sense of, you know, a book, and again, how deep that went, we're never going to know, but enough for her to have this hallucination about Miles talking about her book.
Wow, that's wonderful. So it seems like the publishing of this book is a triumph in itself. I mean, the process, and then it finally happens, and in whatever state she was in, she noticed it, and it all seems like the whole thing is kind of indicative of her life. She was an underdog. She fought. She was in a world dominated by obstacles, and she made it out.
I think you summed it up correctly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, the one thing that I noticed, too, that really struck me, and I came from not first generation, but second generation Italian immigrants, and kind of a lot of things were very stark, and I understood her family lineage pretty intimately. But the thing that I was shocked about was some of the things that happened. I mean, the imagery of that dog getting put in that traffic, and why someone would ever do that to another human being, and just the rape and everything that happened. And I wonder, in her life, from your estimation, as horrific as all of those things were in her early formative years, do you think that's what gave her the gusto to go into a male-dominated profession and do as well as she did?
Well, it's tough to boil it down to that kind of sort of monolithic you know, cause, and then the effect it would have. I took note each time we would go over the galleys how stressed she would get reading the chapters of about her early life. Reliving all of that was very, very difficult for her, and I understood that, and you know, we made we got through things as quickly as we could to spare her. Now, you know, she's the psychology of her upbringing. On the one hand, you've got her mother, who is, I mean, this is my take on it. I mean, since you're asking that question, mother who is trying to get control of her life, you know, who is naive, who's in Appalachia and has this large family and becomes, for all practical purposes, the mother for all the siblings in the family. A father who is controlling. You know, everything. So she's got a nurturing side, and she's got a domineering side, and she's navigating between these two. I found that to be sort of a definition of who she was, because I mean, she was volatile. She extremely warm. Everybody is honey, and she meant it. On the other hand, don't cross her. I mean, she was fierce, and I witnessed both sides on a regular basis. I think that some of it comes from just simply the Sicilian background. Gave her a kind of stamina, a fortitude, just always in with her foot on the accelerator going forward. But there was also a humility that I think comes particularly from her mother's side, so that at the same time that she is a drummer, you know, a driving force in a band, she wants to be underneath. She wants to be supportive. That's her mother, you know. But don't question her viability. Don't question her place, you know, on that bandstand, or she'll cut you off at the knees with a one-liner. You know, so I think that, yeah, all those episodes, I'm sure, fed into her psyche. But I think it's deeper than that in terms of the two psychological dimension, or the psychological dimensions that come out of the two sides of paternal and maternal of her family life growing up.
What you kind of opened up to in this process is that you not only described her life, but you got to be around her and got to get to know her and saw the different sides of the myriads of ways that she is. What did you learn about her that was surprising that maybe you didn't realize before you went into this process of writing her biography?
Dottie had, over the years, I think she was, this is again my take on it, but you know, not that she liked it, but I think she was accustomed and to some extent flourished by being to some extent obscure. Now, again, I'm not saying that she didn't want to make recordings and get more attention, but at the same time, she was never somebody who sought out. I mean, she wasn't a kind of paradiddle drummer, you know, a soloist. She wanted to be underneath, and she would always say, cook them to death, so, you know, or cook them into bad health without them even knowing it. So the amount of I think probably the amount of humility that was, you talked about genes before, genetic templates, that again coming, I think, from her mother's side, that very human quality probably struck me and continues to strike me, I don't want to say more than other things, but it's one of the things that I found to be illuminating about who she was. And there was another part of that I was just trying to think of. So, I mean, it showed up in her interactions with people. It showed up on the bandstand. You know, she always said you can't lie in the bandstand. How she performed on that bandstand is who she really was. And that, I mean, watching her perform and, I mean, listening to her play, and then in intermission, seeing how the people would flock to her from the audience and how she embraced them, I mean, that warm side at the same time, a tremendous drive in her life to succeed. I mean, she wanted to play that music. That music was her life blood. So that was another thing. So there's the humility, and there is the resolute determination to play the music, not to become famous. That's what I meant about, not that she wanted to be obscure, but she didn't want to be famous. She didn't want, you know, I mean, she wasn't looking for fame. She was committed to the music. And that depth, I mean, I think it taught me something in terms of somebody's commitment to an art form, because there's so much emphasis on fame, I mean, increasingly in our society. And she was the antithesis of that. She was there for that art form. And she was part of a group of musicians, a kind of mainstream clique of musicians who were old guard in New York, and there was a compact among them, in terms of keeping that tradition alive, and that meant the world to her. So again, that it took a little bit to kind of figure out what did I learn and what surprised me. So I think it's that combination of fierce determination and humility in the face of the art form and in the face of the tradition.
And you may have just answered this next question with that answer, but I'm curious, you know, longevity is not one of those things that you really can sneeze at in music. It really does take a lot of tenacity to stay relevant and to continue to evolve. And she always did that. What do you think the key to her longevity was?
It's an ineffable quality. You know, she was known as a consummate swing drummer, kind of swing to bop, but a hard swinging drummer with a very, very sure time feel. I mean, a kind of a way of rhythmically phrasing that and setting tempos which were always, it would seem, absolutely right, spot on. And she lived for that. I mean, she is somebody, you know, again, this is my estimation of things, who expressed her intelligence, and she was a smart lady, who expressed her intelligence bodily. And again, I don't say that being dismissive of her ability, because she was a good businesswoman, for instance. So she had the intellectual capacity, but the bodily expression of her intelligence and the necessity for it to be expressed, given her life circumstances, given what her stepfather did with the dog, given her rape, given polio, all of these things that happened to her, it threw into the foreground her need to express herself through bodily activities, sports in high school, jitterbugging, visions of becoming a ballroom dancer, etc. So all of this builds gradually. See, she never got lessons from her father, and she got lessons on the fly from other drummers. So her realization of who she was and what her life's work would be didn't really hit her until several decades down the line. I mean, it's Eugene Wright in about, 1954, and all of a sudden she makes a commitment to becoming a drummer. Well, that's only, 7 years from when she went to New York, and she had to do a lot of woodshedding. So by the time she gets to New York and she has that compressed time from 61 to 75, and then she leaves New York and travels and winds up back at the East Coast again for a number of years. But the New York years, are virtually over, not entirely. The concentration of it begins to dissipate. Well, what kept her going? I think that it took her. It was a very circuitous route to determine what her life's work was going to be, and to commit to it fully and realize what her gifts were and how she might contribute to the tradition that she loved. That's my hunch. This is not something I asked her, but I am giving you my assessment based on what I know of her.
What was the favorite part? Your favorite part of the book to write, to be a part of?
There's a primary favorite and there's a secondary favorite. I enjoy the comic relief in lots of passages in the book, but the number one most sort of illuminating portion of it for me was the education she got from Eugene Wright. I don't know about you, and maybe it's just me, but I had been fascinated for years by this notion of taking of elders within the jazz tradition, taking younger musicians under their wing, and this is the way the education, for so much of jazz history, the education of the newcomers occurred. And I grew up on the East Coast, and I've been to many concerts, many jazz clubs in New York. And the kind of proscribed space that the musicians existed in, up on that stage, the music, of course, drew me to it. But then the world that they existed in was just, this combination of rigor and romance and just mystery. How do they do that? Just mind-boggling what they accomplish. So, and then learning that as opposed to what my lifestyle was about, going to universities and so forth, so many of these people learned on the bandstand. They learned from the people from their predecessors. I thought, that is wonderful. I wish I knew more about this. Well, when I had the opportunity first to talk with Dottie about what Eugene gave her, and the amount of time he spent, and then I spent numbers of hours talking to Eugene about this, and all of a sudden that space on the bandstand, which was mysterious and closed, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean the musicians are about their business, and one isn't going to go up and start asking tons of questions and invading their space when they're professionally active, but this gave me the opportunity in a relaxed setting to have that door, have that space opened up to me. And so that's where I felt the biggest thrill, was learning about that relationship. Now, secondarily, I enjoyed the process of finding numbers of the recordings that Dottie didn't even know existed. When we found those 1949 vocal pieces with Nick Esposito, I mean, I was knocked out by that. And then the Kansas City Women's Jazz Festival, right there in your home turf, that was actually recorded. You know, the 78 concert was actually it exists on tape, and you know that was a thrill to hear Dottie, you know, and then the 1962 dub. I mean, to hear Dottie across a bit of an arc of time, because otherwise it had been just in basically Ruby Braff, and then the mid 1990s, you know, through the early 2000s. So everything had been abbreviated to the last years of her career, but all of a sudden, we've got some illumination, some light shone on, not a whole lot, but some at least, on what she played like and sounded like early on. So that was a big thrill. But the Eugene Wright, the mentorship, passing the torch, understanding how the torch was passed. Wow.
So why should someone buy this book? Talk to me about, in your, you know, kind of being as objective as possible, but also being subjective about it, of course. Why should somebody read this that's interested not only in the world of jazz, but in the history of women in a particularly male-dominated idiom?
Well, you've answered the question in part. I mean, on the one hand, I have felt since the manuscript came together, and continue to feel that, as you just said, you don't have to be interested in jazz to be taken up completely by her story. So the book has a true to life story of about a formidable character in our culture, in our contemporary culture, somebody who existed side by side with us and is a role model. She seems to me to fit entirely into that definition of a true heroine within our culture. So I think that for someone to read it and you know, the parts about that involve the music, discussion of what she learned from Eugene, we took great pains to write it so it would be easily understood by the layperson. In fact, Dottie, see, one of the things, and again, this goes back to an earlier question, Dottie was so fervent about getting what she had learned about the music down on paper in a way that could be understood by students of the music or just the lay public. And then she would become disheartened because she would tell me things, and I would transcribe them and I'd work them, and then she would, well, when she was telling me, she was to try to tell me and go over different, you know, variations on a theme, and then she would just get, you know, feel that it wasn't working. I'll never get it, she'd say. You know, I forget it. We just can't put this in the book because although I want it in there, I don't know how to say it. So I would take it and I would work it, and then I'd read it to her or send it to her, and she'd say, "You got it." You know, and we do it step by step so that, as far as she was concerned, it finally got to a place where the average person could understand it, but it also made, you know, sturdy musical sense. So the layperson who doesn't know anything about jazz, I think, might actually find themselves having an introduction to the genre that's appealing. The story itself, aside from the jazz world, is remarkable, gripping, and I think people would find it to have kind of qualities of a good novel. You know, it's almost you're talking about some of the episodes in it. It's unbelievable to me still that it's exhausting. It's literally exhausting when I go over what this woman went through. It's almost unbelievable that all this happened to one person, and that she came through it. So I think that kind of status that she occupies, that position she occupies as both a musical figure who wants to pay it forward, who wants to document what she learned, pay it forward for the next generations, but also somebody who can join other heroines and other that transcend a genre, transcend a profession, and it joins other figures in our culture who are beginning to get noticed, who have been ignored or shoved aside or simply not given any attention. So she joins the ranks of those people who are finally beginning to get a voice in the culture.
Beautiful. Yeah, this book was really easy to page through and read. And I mean, it was exhausting, but it was also one of those things where you just had to figure out what the next step was. And I noticed even recently in regards to Dottie, there was a few new singles that were put out on Apple Music. And I was actually relieved in conjunction with this book that new music's getting put out there. So hopefully her legacy will shine pretty bright as we all move forward, and I'm looking forward to introducing you and the book and her legacy on the show. So thank you for taking a minute out. Best of health. I hope everything starts getting better in the world here in 2022, so I appreciate it.
Oh, by all means, you're very gracious in your approach, and I appreciate that. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest authors and jazz thinkers in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Wayne for his time and energy. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time. Enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.